Hi, this is Daniel Strauss of Woodruff and Strauss with my co-host, Slate's Betsy Woodruff. First time on, and it's a new day and a new era, Betsy. We are back in the era of Republican control of the House and the Senate. And as an homage to our new Republican overlords, I have the Five on in the background instead of
Best hour of cable
MSNBC,
television.
right?
Although it just changed to Brett Baier, so it's not
It's
quite
not
as
as good.
teacot
You know,
anymore.
I'm actually my preferred Fox show is Outnumbered, which I like for I have many thoughts
For
on.
the intelligent
I
analysis.
there is so much in there, and like, you know, basically part of it I think is a real, I mean, I don't know.
It's a really brilliant show. Roger Ailes is brilliant. That's why Fox
Yeah.
makes so much money and has insane viewership, because Roger Ailes is brilliant. We can all agree on
Yep,
that.
yep. Yeah,
So
but
yes, as you alluded to, I started at Slate. For any viewers who are curious about my personal career journey, I started here 2 weeks ago, and it's been really fantastic. Everyone is super nice. I've been able to write a lot of fun stuff. www.slate.com if you're not familiar. And I'm on the politics team, so it's been really fun.
And you've been traveling around a little bit. You just got back for, can you, by the way, can you talk for a little bit about like your thing about like being on the road and not having to deal with like press flacks or something? Just like,
I can do that. So yeah, I went to Wisconsin. I left on Friday. Yeah, I left Friday and was there Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, covering Scott Walker, so following him around. And I don't want to say anything bad about anybody who works on his team, but for whatever reasons, it became kind of clear early on to me and to a couple other reporters who were there that they weren't necessarily the fastest responding flacks, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. So for most of the trip, I just really didn't talk to their comms team at all, and it was kind of nice. I feel like it can often be easy for politics reporters to start leaning really hard on people whose job it is to talk to politics reporters,
yep.
and a lot of those people are great at their jobs and really helpful and fantastic. But you can kind of get you can sort of get stuck in this messaging warp, right? And start thinking about these things in terms of one side's messaging versus another side's messaging, and is our message going to win? Important things can get lost in the interim. So for this trip, I focused more on paying a lot of attention to what candidates said on the stump, which usually I just tune out stump speeches. But I tried to like pay more attention, suss out themes, talk about larger issues, and there was some interesting stuff. And I also talked more with other reporters who are covering it and with some of the think tank policy people at the Victory Party. So it was fun. I almost want to swear off flacks, just never talk to them anymore. I'm hardly getting any flack emails at my new Slate email, and it's awesome. I don't want to get any of them.
I mean, partially it's because, you know, the election happened yesterday and we're all done with the D triple C's, you know, doom and gloom.
With the D
Like,
ship's correct
yeah,
predictions.
the D trips. Yeah, you're right. So the one thing about this is that, like, for the viewers, the D triple C, I'm sure they all know this actually,
They probably
is
don't.
the most, is
The
probably
Democratic
the,
Congressional Campaign
yeah,
Committee,
they are
which is the
probably
arm of the
the.
Democratic Party responsible for winning House seats. It's
Well, they
called the
didn't do that.
DCCC, and cool insiders in this town like to call it the D trip. So the more you know.
This cycle, they were notable among all of the committees for really, really apocalyptic sounding emails. It'd be things like, I don't know,
All
you
hope is
know,
gone.
yeah, subject line Nancy Pelosi, we're dead. And
Yeah.
then in there, it'd be like, well, we're not really dead, but wouldn't losing seats be like death?
Or you get an
Wouldn't it,
email
you know?
from, or you get an email and the sender is Barack Obama and the subject line is, Betsy, I'm desperate.
I got a lot of haze too, like,
Yeah.
hey, or you got a
Oh,
second or
Christ.
$5
Other
kind of.
flags have started doing that, and that's so annoying. Because I tend to assume hate emails are from people I know. And it's like they violated the sanctity of the hey subject line. It's no longer a reliable indicator that I'm going to be having a meaningful email interchange. But alas, so we're thinking talk about Senate, talk quickly about some of the House races, talk about governor's races, and then at the very end, maybe sound off on some holiday themes.
Yes.
Awesome.
So last night, the GOP picked up 7 seats. They surprised me personally. I guess because I had predicted personally that Kay Hagan would win, as essentially every poll showed.
Right.
I'm
pretty sure every poll.
Almost every poll. There was a Civitas poll right before the election that said Tillis was ahead by 2, which turned out to be exactly right. But most polling showed that she was ahead. Internal polling from the Hagan campaign, I can say now, showed her ahead. The Hagan campaign was unique among campaigns this cycle, and they didn't release internal polls. They never dropped one partially because I was told by Hagan aides that she's a really good fundraiser. She's a background in banking as a banking lawyer, and they were ahead. And their philosophy was you only release internals when you're losing. The Tillis campaign released a few internals, I think. And one of your colleagues, Rebecca Berg at the Washington Examiner, right before the election, was able to get on a call with donors, and where Tom Tillis, Senator-elect Tom Tillis's chief strategist, said, you know, our internals have essentially never shown us ahead of Hagan.
Huh.
So they were all wrong, because Hagan lost.
And, which is nuts.
Right. She was supposed to be the one silver lining. I never make predictions in my office. I was predicting Hagan would win. I was wrong.
Bad night for Emily's list, too. And we can talk about this later, but they spent a lot of money on Hagan.
Hagan is, I think, one of the...
The most expensive Senate race of the cycle is North Carolina.
Yeah.
Spent a lot of money, which is kind of odd because their media markets aren't particularly expensive. Just a huge amount of money. A lot of money on Hagan. Emily's list also invested a ton in Mary Burke in Wisconsin. She got demolished. I mean, demolished maybe a strong word. She got beat very decisively.
Right.
It's always fun paying attention to like who endorses who and who donates to who and how those guys are doing. So Hagan's loss is a loss for a lot of people.
Yeah. Hagan lost. We knew Joni Ernst would win in Iowa, which is not so big of a surprise. It kind of was like...
I was kind of surprised.
Really?
I was not confident either way. I expected Hagan to win. I didn't have a strong expectation with Iowa,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense.
Let's see. Who else was there? We had a list yesterday.
So another race I think is really interesting that I would like to yell about a little bit. Not yell, but I have strong emotions and feelings. Is the Virginia Senate race.
Oh, right. I wrote about that
which we don't have the official results. Looks like Warner's going to pull it out, but they're canvassing, which is when they go through every single vote, all the absentees, make 100% sure they've counted everything, because it looks like Warner's up by maybe 12,000 votes. And what, something like, did 2 million people vote? 1 million people vote? 2.1 million, yeah. Just huge race, and he's up by just the tiniest little margin. I kind of expected this to happen. I didn't expect it to be this close, but I definitely expected it to be closer than polls were showing. And the reason for that is because Virginia polling is really, really bad. Like, they're always wrong. When Cuccinelli was running for governor in 2013, all the polls showed him down by 10. He ended up losing by like barely 2 points, even though he was badly outspent. If he'd had polling showing he was only losing by 2 points, national money would have come in. He would have gotten more backing. There would have been more energy among the base. People would have showed up. Turnout would have been better. There's a very good chance he would have won. If you have October 2013 polls showing Cuccinelli down by just 2, there's a good chance we'd have Governor Cuccinelli. And then the obvious example is Virginia 7, where Eric Cantor lost his primary to Dave Brat because all the polling was just hysterically bad, and a whole bunch of people should be fired for that. Like, lose their jobs, like, knowing we're able to work in this industry, because just joke, terrible polls. And we have the same thing happen with the Virginia Senate race. Gillespie ran out of money at the end. He was hardly on TV. the race got basically no national media attention, myself included, even though it's right next to DC and it's the easiest thing ever for DC politics reporters to cover this stuff. Nobody talked about it. There was a late breaking Mark Warner scandal where it sounds like he discussed potentially bribing
right.
a state senator to step down. Didn't actually do it, but discussed it, which is very bad. And we didn't realize this race was close. So my point here is something that we hear over and over and over and often make fun of is this line that losing candidates use where they say the only poll that matters is the poll on election day. Well, that's funny. Okay, that merits ridicule, first off, because it means you're losing. It means you're ignoring polls. But it's also a lie. Polls matter. Polls yeah. before election
oh,
day
matter.
They
matter a lot.
They matter a ton. And this is something that like I did not realize until I started covering politics. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't cover politics, like why would you geek out about like, oh, how do polls affect donor behavior? Like you wouldn't pay attention to it. But this is constantly striking me. Like if polls show you're losing by 10 points, you're not going to be able to raise money. Your volunteers aren't going to show up.
Wendy Davis. Right.
Well, but that was. But I mean.
Okay. Well, let's.
That's not a polling problem. The polls were right there, though.
Right.
Like, those
okay.
Polls
but there,
were all
I'm
correct.
Just thinking of a race where a candidate is down 10 points and lost. Just.
I think maybe the inverse of this might be New Hampshire, where
okay.
polls showed it was going to be really close, and Scott Brown ended up getting beaten pretty decisively.
Yeah.
What's another example of a race? I feel like all these races are in Virginia. So just the fact that. In my opinion, you know, the National Republican Senatorial Committee, the NRSC, obviously had a great night last night. A lot of their guys won. Very exciting. I'm sure they're all still hungover today. But I'm confident there's a lot of remorse that they didn't figure out Gillespie was so close, because winning that seat would have been huge for Republicans. They haven't won a statewide race in Virginia in a while. Had a very rough go in that state. They should be winning these off-year statewide races in Virginia. The fact that they're going to lose because and might have won if they put in another couple hundred dollars at the very end, that hurts a lot. That's really bad.
Did you I mean the thing about this race, about Virginia, that struck me also was like, what does it say that it was close? I mean, so
well,
the thing
I think what it says is that Virginia is not a blue state.
Right.
Part of the problem is the Virginia Republican Party is very divided. You have conservatives, social conservatives, Tea Party, libertarian types all in one loose camp. And you have your business interest, Bill Bowling types in another camp, and they really don't like each other. And they don't necessarily work together very well. And there's a lot of distrust and a lot of animosity. And Gillespie was really a good candidate because he was able to communicate with both of those groups, reached out to everyone, called Dave Brath, an IDB, Eric Cantor, congratulated him, said he was excited about campaigning with him. Stuff like that. Gillespie worked really hard to sort of unite people. And I think that means he might have a future in Virginia politics.
Well, the rumor is that this is like a trial run for him to run for governor one day.
If so, pretty darn good trial run.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the truth. And
it shouldn't even have been a trial run. You should have won.
So let me – okay. So here's the thing. So I wrote a story about this today. And I talked to some political scientists and some people on this. And the thing that they told me was that Gillespie actually did better under these current conditions because – he partially did well because, frankly, Warner himself thought he would just trounce him. And so, and we got some reader emails from people in the state today saying like, yeah, you know, I'm a pretty active voter. They never call, you know, the Warner people didn't call me and I noticed that. And so I just assumed they had this locked up and they were pretty damn confident.
Interesting.
Guess they weren't. So the argument that I heard was that if Gillespie had come in, and if the NRSC had known that Gillespie was competitive, they would have started pouring money in there. And then the
yeah.
DSCC would have been like, oh, I guess we got to pour money in too.
Yeah.
So the situation
so
might
the
have been
So the sneak attack
different.
Might not have worked.
But we
and
don't
I've
know
heard that.
That.
Too. I've heard that. I haven't heard that argument in this case, but mm-hmm. I have heard arguments like that. Like if Eric Cantor had polling showing,
right.
he would have campaigned.
But
that's possible.
But in this situation, though, that assumes also that that assumes a vacuum. Like the Democrats were defending a lot of seats, a lot of places, and money was scarce, and there were
yeah.
there were money disagreements, you know.
Lots of hurt feelings and anger.
Right. And in Iowa, I mean, there was a story today in the Washington Post about Democrats hitting up the president to move money from the DNC to the Senate Majority PAC. You know, in Iowa, Bruce Braley's aides and supporters went to Tom Harkin, who had this little nest egg for a public policy institute. That didn't happen either. So, I mean, it's just so... But that's, I guess, the argument. I don't really know what happened.
I think that's probably true in some cases, that people are so clueless that you have sort of these sneak attack things.
I got to be honest, Betsy, though, like, it just seems like with a lot of these races, I mean, so they needed 6 seats. They won 7. I thought they were just going to get 6.
Mm-hmm.
I thought something would have backfired, but it was so clean last night in their victories. And, like, we should have known because, you know, people started saying, why isn't Hagan locked this up yet? And it took a long time. And you should have known if it was taking a long time that something was wrong. And
also,
then I emailed the Hagan people and they were like, yeah, something isn't going well.
Also worth noting here, they've got 7 seats, but they're probably going to get Louisiana in the runoff.
Right.
And Alaska hasn't officially been counted, right?
Right.
Because it's hit a
sound. We're going to know next week on Alaska.
Yeah. So it could be...
9.
It could be 9. Right. Yeah. And there's probably like a 2% chance Virginia will turn around.
That's a lot.
Which shouldn't be expected. 9 is a lot.
But
yeah.
I think, I mean, the thing about this is that it just seems to me... The outcome of this really isn't. It's. I don't know if it's a wave, but it's a big splash. Like
I think it's a wave. I didn't think it was a wave until Brownback won.
Yeah, who saw that coming? Okay.
I mean,
Brownback was down 10 points.
I thought he would win just because Kansas is so Republican, and Republicans have been running that state for so long. But then when he won by a lot, and when Pat Roberts won, it was like, okay. You know, you have Rick Scott winning. That's a wave thing. The Republican winning the Maryland governorship and the Maryland lieutenant governorship. That's nuts. Like, that's a wave.
So, I mean, it's just hard to – it is hard to look at that, look at all these victories everywhere and say that this is anything but a referendum on the president. Because, I mean, all these races are different. And for hitting, like – major blue strongholds like the Maryland governor's mansion, it's hard to say that, you know, the one uniting factor doesn't relate to the fact that President Obama is, I mean, he's not as unpopular as President Bush was in Bush's time
mm-hmm.
in office, but he's not near Reagan or Clinton.
Right. So another thing that's interesting, if you're going to make the case for it being a wave election, and I just want to pull the numbers up on here to make sure that I've got it right. But another big indicator is Paul LePage in Maine.
Yeah, also.
Because he should have lost. Paul, and here's what's nuts about Paul LePage.
Really, what's nuts about Paul LePage, Betsy?
What's not nuts about Paul LePage? Paul LePage is way too conservative for Maine. He's super pro-life. He's very Tea Party. I think at one point he said he doesn't think the minimum wage should exist. There was a story that came out that said he was palling around with survivalists that you guys published. That was a great scoop on your end. So here's what's interesting about Paul LePage. His plan or what his strategy had to be was have there be a third party candidate and LePage gets 38%. Historically, LePage never gets more than 38%. That's what he pulls. That's how he won in 2010. 38% of Maine voters love Paul LePage, think he's awesome, are going to show up for him, are going to vote for him. And there has to be a third party candidate to divide those other votes in half so that he can beat the Democrat. However, and this is where you start making a wave argument. Last night, LePage got 48% of the vote. That's nuts.
Yeah.
That's like Michoud, the Democrat, got 43. I mean, that's where we're no longer talking vulnerable Republicans taking on by the skin of their teeth. We're talking a guy who is the most interesting governor in America. Getting 10
I'm
points
saying
more.
A lot. There are some colorful
governors
out there.
And there are some interesting guys. Yeah, exactly. So maybe we should segue into talking about governors now.
Yeah, but one thing I want to, even before that, I just want to ask you, like, because the Senate was high noon. That was the battle zone, right?
Mm-hmm.
The idea going into election night yesterday was that Democrats would pick up a few governor's mansions. They would not keep the House, and nobody knew what was going to happen in the Senate. So do you think this means that the Ebola attacks, the personhood attacks, the tie everything to Obama attacks that Tillis, that every Republican was doing, worked? Because reporting, polling, going into that said that it varied or didn't always work.
Well, it sounds like the Republican playbook was, say, criticize Obama.
Betsy? Yeah, go on.
Run an ad saying Obama did this thing wrong, and this senator, Mark Pryor, voted with Obama 99% of the time. And we see different permutations of that ad in every single race. We see that over and over. We see that applying to a bunch of different things. That was sort of the basic model of their messaging. Yeah.
In Georgia, David Perdue had this thing where, like, during a debate, David Perdue, the senator-elect David Perdue, had this thing in the debate where he would, like, answer any question and just segue back to Michelle Nunn, the Democratic candidate, and be like, and that's why a vote for Michelle Nunn is a vote for Obama. And he'd smile, like, every time. It was almost like SNL, where, you know, but he'd do it every time. He'd just, like, you know, trade, and that's why a vote for Michelle Nunn is a vote for Obama. And it worked.
It works, yeah, it works.
Perdue was expected to make a runoff with Michelle Nunn. Yeah. Both sides said that
was
likely
to
happen.
Perdue was capped at 48. He didn't pull above 48.
Perdue won outright.
Yeah, and won well.
Yep.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Amazing. Absolutely fascinating.
The other thing, though, is, like, should we trust polling? I just feel, I mean, like, someone pointed out to me today, the Hagan, it's not an upset in Hagan's race because it was always in the margin of error for all these polls that showed
the same
thing. But it feels like a polling catastrophe.
I think that's fair.
Not just with Hagan, but everywhere.
everywhere, yeah. So on that note, I was in Wisconsin, obviously covering the governor's race, and there was, most of the polls were showing Walker up by 1 or 2 points within the margin of error. Real Clear Politics rated the race a toss up, and then there was this one poll from Marquette University that showed Walker up by 7. And I kind of rolled my eyes at that. And at one point on the campaign trail in Eau Claire, Walker mentioned, oh, yeah, well, this Marquette poll showed we're up by 7. We're not up by that much. Like, you know, Walker told his supporters, we're not doing as well as this poll shows. And I wrote my story that day, and I was just describing the state of the race. And I said something to the effect of, Real Clear, their polling average has Walker up by 2.2 points, and that's inflated by this weird 7-point poll that nobody takes seriously. Wrong! The 7-point poll was right! All the other polls were wrong!
Do you think we're being played, though?
Some very astute readers have been needling me for that, which is well-deserved.
As a rule in this business, you don't read the comments, but you can't get away from readers. You really can't.
Well, Twitter. I was wrong. They were right. You know? Reading crowd. Nothing else to be said. So, yeah. I agree. I think...
Are we being played, though? Do you think? Well, no, I'm almost serious. Like, is the new tell, like, is the new we're not up by that much, the new internal poll, you know, where, yeah, who the fuck knows? You know, I don't know. But, like, I feel like we've just gotten to an insane point with polling where we aren't just paying attention to individual polls anymore. We're paying attention to forecasters, and forecasters
are
not
always
right now.
Paying attention to all these different forecasters,
right? And they're like,
and I think there's a point where, like, this information stops being valuable
of the forecasts now, or something. Like, it's getting ridiculous.
It's there's a point where it's like, I thought this was funny on Twitter, but nobody else did.
I thought it was funny, Betsy. I will always think it's funny.
There were four different forecasters. One's Republicans have a 97% chance. One says Republicans have a 95% chance. One says they have an 86% chance. So I added them all up, divided by 4. This is the real chance. This is the forecast average.
What was the forecast?
Something like 86.2 or something.
Well,
now you
it
know.
Worked out.
Now you know. Here's a valuable piece of information for you guys. But see, this is also something that I think I'm torn about, and about horse race coverage. It's really fun and interesting and valuable, and I think nothing wrong with covering the horse race. Like, that's what I've been doing. But I think it's often easy to lose sight of bigger issues in elections when people are covering horse race stuff. And instead of people writing about, here's the ideas, here's policy changes that could happen, especially with governor's races, you know, here are substantive ways that the outcome of these elections will affect people's lives. Instead, it seems like 95% of coverage is, this poll came out, this person's up by this much, oh, this Oppo thing came out. And it doesn't actually talk about the issues. I think his name is Dante Atkins. Is that his last name? Guy at the Daily Coast.
Yep.
He's a really nice guy. I was on Twitter maybe 2 or 3 days ago, and he just tweeted in all caps, Joni Ernst is batshit fucking crazy, and nobody in the media is doing their job. And, like, I take issue with that characterization. No, that's not correct. But the larger point is, all the coverage of the Iowa race was Joni Ernst is winning. Bruce Braley's having issues. Tom Harkin said this really stupid sexist thing, and that's what Bruce Braley's going to be talking about for the last 24 hours of his campaign. Ooh, look, here's another poll showing Joni Ernst winning. And there was much less coverage of what issues would Joni Ernst focus on, or what was her record in the state Senate, or what was Braley's record in Congress, or what do these mean policy-wise? And I don't know. I don't...
No, you saw me make that face, didn't you? Oh, my God, this is the first... you know, stumble we've had on actually being able to see each other in blogging heads. I don't know if that because of the new system. I think that's a weird example because, like, the thing about Ernst is that she might have been the most exciting candidate this cycle. Like, I don't remember anyone else using the word charisma. I hate that word. That word was used on Obama a lot in 2008. Just like, you know, yeah. It's this like charisma thing. What the
right.
heck?
It doesn't
does
really
that
mean anything. Right.
It doesn't mean anything, but like Ernst had it. And I think that did distract from it somewhat. You're right. There was a lot of like, there just was not as much attention to the policy positions of these two, which is kind of why Joni Ernst, Senator-elect Joni Ernst, is kind of a mystery in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the one policy thing that did draw a lot of attention to her was when she talked about the military sexual assault right. cases.
I found that
out of
fascinating.
Take.
My
Me
editor
too.
Found
yeah.
that fascinating.
Definitely.
You know, and that's significant. I mean, we should go back on it. It's only day one since Republicans became the majority, but it doesn't sound like I've been hearing a lot of national security stuff, a lot of immigration stuff today. It doesn't sound like we're going to talk about sexual assault anytime soon.
Yeah, that's not something I see Republicans pushing for like, in the next 2 years.
Why is that, though? Because it is something
I mean, it's
that's
not really
so
a winning,
complicated.
But it's not really a winning issue for them because it divides their party. It's not a winning issue for anybody in their party. Whereas with Democrats, it's a women's issue that they can talk about. With Republicans, it's the military gets pissed. Like Republicans bank on military votes. They get pissed about this stuff when you start messing with chain of command. And there's so much other stuff Republicans want to do. There's only a finite amount of time in the next 2 years that I think they're going to be focusing on sort of the marquee issues like tax reform. And
so we got off this, but I want to go ask you about governors, because I think one of the most fascinating things about this cycle is that for a lot of these governors races that were supposed to be vulnerable, they were supposed to be referendums on the incumbent governors.
Mm-hmm.
So the candidates were really like challenges to Paula Page's record, Scott
right.
Walker's record,
right.
Rick Scott's record, Sam Brownback's record.
Mm-hmm.
All four of those guys won re-election. All four. Which is unbelievable to me.
Yeah, it is.
And it's unbelievable because nationally, this wave, as we're calling it, was a referendum. To only make sense of that, the only way to really make sense of why Kay Hagan lost, but also why... I don't know, Purdue outright won,
yeah.
Or they had a D next to their name. They're Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it was a, but the referendum thing didn't work on the other side around. And these are states where, I mean, like, there were a lot of people really pissed at Sam Brownback, like angry at him.
Yes.
And there are Republicans who are angry at him because they feel that the tax cuts went way too far.
Yeah.
But they reelected him.
Yep,
and
by a lot.
Pat Quinn in Illinois, in a similar situation, hardly as high profile a governor, but he suffers from a very technical economic issue, pensions, lost to Bruce Rauner.
Yeah.
So
I haven't followed the way Brownback has campaigned that much, so I can't speak. I don't have any special Gnostic insight into that particular race. But I think Walker's really interesting here because he was perceived as vulnerable, you know, as a GOP governor who was in trouble, which obviously was not the case, but that's what people were hearing. That's what he was saying. That's how Democrats were talking about the race. Michelle Obama went to Wisconsin twice. The president went there once. There was definitely a sense, at least in national media, and I think also decently in Wisconsin, that he was in a lot of trouble. That it was going to be very difficult for him to get reelected. And I think what's interesting about Walker's race is that he made that race. So rather, you know, I think it's easy to say this cycle had an anti-incumbent mood, but I don't think that's actually true. I think this cycle more has an anti-Washington mood. Mm-hmm. So in Scott Walker's case, every single campaign stop he made, every speech he gave, every time he opened his mouth, he said he talked about the Washington special interests who were backing his opponent. He took every chance he could to criticize Washington. He said, people in Washington think this, but I think this, and that's why Wisconsin is awesome. And rather than even talking about Mary Burke that much, or even talking about the president, he really didn't talk about the president, he talked about Washington. Washington is bad, Wisconsin is good. That was what you heard over and over. And I think for maybe for voters who are hearing that message, it becomes less about, I want to get rid of the incumbent because I'm frustrated with reality, and more about Washington is bad, but things going on in the rest of America are not, and I want to be on the side of not Washington, which is a reasonable place to be at. You know, that's understandable. I think that's a rational voter response.
And if you think about it, there are a lot of these Democratic candidates this cycle had connections to Washington.
Yeah.
The Democratic candidate for governor in Maine is a congressman.
Mm-hmm.
Michelle Nunn, deep, deep ties to Washington. Her dad was a influential senator. She worked for the Points of Light Foundation, which she called attention to endlessly.
Charlie Crist.
I think one of the top three insiders of all time.
Are Democrats even sad about him losing? How many people are like, oh, no.
I mean, this
Charlie
is the
Crist
thing about those
governor.
Races. Democrats, I think, are more sad. I mean, I think Democrats are more sad they couldn't beat these guys.
Yeah.
It's not so much that they lost these big champions.
I think that's the same thing. I think that's true with Wisconsin, too. Nobody... I don't think, you know, people I talk to are like, people aren't coming out to vote because they like Mary Burke. They're coming out to vote because they hate Scott.
Right. These were protest votes in the gubernatorial.
They could have picked somebody randomly from the phone book and the outcome would have been comparable.
Although
in Florida, Crist is...
Right. Florida,
just,
we wrote this up
once. Just a teensy bit flawed.
We wrote this up. There was a poll that found like Crist versus Scott were the two least likable candidates going against each other in the country. Like, they were the most reviled.
And they both have, like, 100% name ID.
I mean, their name ID was way up. If anything, their advisors were saying, let's pretend you're someone else. Let's not call attention to that today. But let me ask you this now. I mean, what do you think... what was your sense from Democrats in Wisconsin? Because the tricky thing about Wisconsin Democrats is that there's still sort of hard feelings, as I understand it, about recalling Walker in the same way that not every Republican is very excited when someone says impeach the president.
yeah, no kidding.
There, what I've been told
is that... I think it's safe to say not every Republican wants to impeach the president.
I think that's clear. but you know, this is my understanding is that it's very divided on the left on this. Some people said that the recalls went too far. They missed their real chance at taking out Burke. The mayor of Milwaukee, I think, I'm going to get this wrong, who challenged Walker previously, as I understand it, was more of an exciting candidate to a big portion of Wisconsin voters and Wisconsin Democrats, and that didn't happen.
One thing I heard was that if Ron Kind had run, he's a congressman from Wisconsin, it could have been a different night. Because people knew him. You know, the advantage of Burke is that she could get money from Emily's list, and she was kind of coronated, as I understand. People picked her. She didn't have a very challenging primary. The Democrats were sort of nudged out, and you know, Burke was going to be it, which is a reasonable strategy. You know, have, if you're in a tough race, try to keep your candidate from having to spend too much money and energy on the primary. But I think having a candidate who'd actually excited some Democrats would have been helpful. So that's one thing about that race. And I think the other thing, is that there absolutely seems to be a lot of residual anger over the recall. One thing I heard from Republicans was that things started really looking up for Walker about a month ago when the race started feeling kind of recall-esque, you know, when major national surrogates started coming in for Mary Burke, and she put up a bunch of very negative ads going after Walker, and all of a sudden you have ads about Walker and the John Doe investigation, which is unresolved and complicated, and the 30-second version is Scott Walker has bad friends. And I think that, and what I heard from people was things started looking better for Walker. And Wisconsinites remembered, we don't like this kind of hysteria. We don't like this kind of anger. We don't like politics that are this emotional. And Burke came to be associated with that style of Wisconsin politics. While Walker, when he's on the stump talking, is literally the nicest human being in the entire world. I don't think he mentioned Burke at all. Every stump speech he gave was, I love the Green Bay Packers, and we're number four in the Midwest for job growth, and you get to keep another $322 every year, and...
You're welcome.
Yeah, that's basically it. Like, very positive.
You can buy an Xbox.
Very even keel. So none of, you know, none of these histrionics and stuff. I think people didn't like having tons of protesters in Madison. They didn't like that the Capitol was full of people camping out for 2 weeks. What I heard was Mary Burke was automatically going to get 46% of the vote because Wisconsin is a blue state. And she automatically, if they picked a name randomly from the phone book, she was going to get 46%. A lot of people don't like Scott Walker. He has a lot of opposition. But it's getting that extra 5%. And that didn't happen.
Let me. I want to just hit on one more gubernatorial race that I know that you're going to go, oh, right, we need to talk about that one before we do. And I hit on with Jeff Blair in the previous Blogging Heads episode. Before we do that, but we're obligated to hit this very quickly. Martha Coakley.
Oh in man, Massachusetts, you're right. We do have to talk about that one.
Lost. Again.
How much did she lose by?
I don't know.
I'm going to blow it up.
That was not my race.
There's a point where you just have to feel very sad for her.
Oh. Now, a few caveats.
Right? There's a point where it's just like, this is sad. Like, we feel bad for this person. So she didn't even lose by a ton. She lost, like, Baker had 48.46. Coakley got 46.6.
So
it's a close race.
Yeah.
It has
the Martha Coakley touch on it, though. Right? Democrats have always felt kind of angry nationally at Martha Coakley. They felt for throwing, they blame her, I think, for throwing the Massachusetts Senate race that birthed Senator Scott Walker. But, you know, the left shouldn't be too unhappy because in the end, Elizabeth Warren came out of that, I guess. I don't know.
Phoenix rose from the ashes.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
And Obamacare still passed.
And there are Republicans who are saying, you know, look, we're not going to repeal it. So.
And then Scott Brown went and ran a Muppety campaign.
And then Scott Brown ran in a different state and lost there, which was bizarre, which was strange.
Yeah.
You knew that pitch was kind of weird when, you know, he announced and he had advisors saying he practically grew up in New Hampshire. Okay.
I watched a lot of MSNBC yesterday, sort of like the dead time when there's nothing to cover.
Yeah.
And they show this clip a bunch of Alex Wagner, like, following Scott Brown around and being like, so what's going to happen to your zip code? Huh? You're going to move?
He was not
if you
a
lose?
Menace, right?
And he goes, that's a silly question. But, like, it is a silly question, but it's also reasonable.
It's
like,
a silly
I would like
candidacy. Am I right, Scott?
Waka waka.
So I, yeah, maybe there isn't much to say about it. She lost. There's a history of Massachusetts voters having a Republican governor, cough Romney.
Baker Mentum, Baker 2016. It could happen.
Maybe. I've seen Baker. Baker seems like he does not seem like presidential material. But I want to hit on this last thing before we move on here. What do you think is going to happen to the Democratic Party now? And what happened? I mean, you were skeptical for a while of, this Democratic focus on women's issues and contraception, and you thought it would backfire. And you thought these candidates who were pivoting and saying, I'm cool with making over-the-counter birth control easier to access, did pretty well. I think of the four that did this, Tillis won, Gardner won, Mike Madden lost, and Rob Manis, or Mike McFadden in Minnesota, and Manis in Louisiana is going to lose.
And Manis doesn't even really count because he was always sort of a sad sack.
But those were the big four that
Gardner winning is Gardner and Tillis winning on that issue are the big deal because North Carolina pushed through stricter abortion laws when Tillis was Speaker of the House there. And him being able to pivot and say, I'm okay with single women and I want it to be easier to get birth control. He won. That's a big deal.
Okay. Well, I want to hear your thoughts on this. Was that a dumb move? Do you think that was just transparently like a move Democrats took to just get votes and
they pushed
too hard on that? Okay.
I think so. If the only thing your party is talking about is abortion and condoms getting banned, and if that's what you're saying, that is not an inspiring message.
No.
There's a certain sector of the Democratic Party that's very galvanized by reproductive rights issues, but it's not big enough to win elections in North Carolina. It's not big enough to win elections in Colorado. And eventually, like, other voters who might care about these issues, but not enough to get them to the polls, not enough to get them to donate, kind of secondary or tertiary issues for them, might feel like their main things are being overlooked. Like, there was this amazing Guardian article that came out the day before, I think on Monday. And this is like why this is very inspiring article. This is like why it's valuable to have reporters on the ground following candidates around when they're stumping. Because Udall apparently was giving a speech to a bunch of volunteers and stuff. And it's not a policy speech. He's just talking about we're gonna win. He literally said, ignore the polls. It just kinda like rah rah, exciting speech. And then the one policy issue he touches on is he says, and by the way, I'm really proud to stand for reproductive justice. And then somebody in the crowd yells, that's not your only fucking issue. Jesus Christ. And it turns out the person who yelled that is a top donor to Colorado Democrats. And the reporter found him after. He's like a millionaire Wall Street guy.
Well, you know, if you're a millionaire donating.
And he was pissed at Udall because Udall's running this dopey campaign where the only thing he wants to talk about is abortion. So Udall got heckled by his own donor.
Okay.
Oh, you know what else? Hang on. I have to pull this up. This is amazing. The other thing is the reporter talked to him after, and this donor was just obviously so angry. Let me just find the specific quote. It's phenomenal. And it's amazing to me that like that a donor would be this candid. The donor goes, he goes, who's running the worst campaign? Him. Because fucking abortion is all he talks about.
He
should not talk about it anymore whatsoever.
Like, what did he think would happen? Of course, Udall couldn't say shit because what's going to happen then? Donor pulls the money.
I mean, if it's 24 hours before election day.
That is essentially your boss.
Yeah, right.
Yelling
and
in the crowd.
Apparently the Guardian article said this donor like watched a Meet the Press panel make fun of Udall for only talking about abortion. So yeah, I mean, you can't be a single issue party. It doesn't work. obviously, it's always going to be an important part of the Democratic Party's platform, important part of their message.
But you think they pushed too hard here?
Yeah, definitely.
Do you think Republicans this cycle were, I mean, what was the appeal? Or was it just backlash? Because I mean, frankly, Betsy, when I get down to it, I mean, this wasn't a very inspired election. I thought, I mean, listen, a lot of these candidates were protest candidates that Democrats put up to challenge incumbents, and the other side, these candidates weren't really super inspiring.
Yeah.
They say Cory Gardner is like crazy inspiring, crazy sort of fun, and my colleague likes to quote an article from Josh Green at Bloomberg that describes Gardner as like, Gardner has the air and the look of someone who just found out he won the lottery or something. He's just sort of like, you know, very excited all the time and looks like overwhelmed, just sort of like, moi? You know,
cool.
I mean, what do you think? How would you characterize this? Were Republicans kind of inspiring? Were Democrats just not inspiring?
I don't think Republicans were inspiring. I don't think anybody said, this amazing policy idea that Republicans have makes me feel good, and therefore I'm going to go vote for them. I don't think anybody said that.
So it was kind of just a cynical election.
I mean, I don't think it's cynical to say you're not happy about leadership, and therefore you're going to vote for somebody else. I don't think that's cynical. I think not voting is cynical. But I think saying people in Washington are doing a bad job handling things and I want to vote for somebody who seems to have an air of competence, I think that's reasonable. I don't think you can criticize voters for voting that way. but I mean, it's not the kind of election where like people are going to vote and then go join the Peace Corps.
Right.
I mean, so I don't know. That's interesting.
I don't know. I remember in 2012, campaign reporters were like, this is an exceptionally awful election, especially near the end when it was, you know, Romney's guys versus Obama's reelect team. Both I would characterize as very aggressive and tireless on both ends. All
yeah.
Right? It wasn't as bad as that one. And that was my first presidential election. But it wasn't terribly fun for me this time.
I think that's fair.
I don't know. And I'm a little pessimistic about this. I gotta be honest. I sort of talked very briefly with my boss today about what I would be doing next. And like 2016, it's going to be just clean out on the left and, you know, what Hillary's going to do and how she thinks the Democratic Party.
I'm already tired of hearing about Hillary.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you're going to hear a lot more. Okay. A lot. Get used to it. And then it's going to be this insane bloodbath free-for-all on the right between tier one, tier one and a half, and tier two candidates all going at each other, which, trust me, actually can be a lot of fun.
That'll be fun. I'm excited about that.
I got a bad feeling about this. And every time I have a bad feeling about something, it works out great. I mean, again, I'm consistently wrong. I am consistently wrong, Betsy. Let me stress that.
You said you thought Walker was going to win.
I did. So, okay. So my record in the end was I thought Davis would lose. Davis in Texas would lose.
Bold prediction.
I thought Davis in Kansas would win. Hagan would win. I thought Shaheen would win. I thought...
I thought Fryer would win.
Yeah, so I spent a lot of time reporting on that, and there was definitely a point where it seemed like Pryor would win, but there was just a turn, and I think if you were to match all the polls in all these races and just put it into one sort of favorability thing, I think there was a spike that went the Democrats' way in the end.
Yeah, I think Pryor, the Ebola ISIS stuff was really bad for Democratic candidates, even though the Senate did not cause the Ebola outbreak.
Yeah, it just gave something.
I think there's a sense of incompetence.
Yeah.
And things are bad and they're not getting fixed. And therefore, I'm going to get rid of these people.
Yeah.
I think.
But it's not. I mean, the truth is, it just strikes me as like a really cynical time because like the truth is, bringing in Republicans in the House and the Senate isn't going to change much.
I don't know. I think I
really you think there's going to be a new level coming.
I mean, George W. Bush got stuff done with Democratic Congress. Bill Clinton got stuff done with Democratic Congress.
Republican Congress.
Yeah. I think there's going to be an expectation that they'll try to play ball together,
and
I think they
why
don't.
Why is that? Because I have a theory on why that would be, but I want to hear it from you.
I mean, because Obama wants to have a legacy. He wants to have gotten things done. He entered politics as the guy who could transcend these divides and as the guy who could help people from different backgrounds and ethnicities and ideologies like each other, as somebody people could rally around. And I think there's some issues that Republicans and the president can work on. You know, criminal justice reform, like tax reform. There's stuff that can get done.
So I think that, I mean, the GOP is in a great position right now in the short run, but they also are in a perilous position. Because on the one hand, they want to make Democrats look bad, and so they want to be sending bills Obama's
right.
way.
They want Obama to veto
so,
a bunch
right,
of stuff.
So Obama to be the obstructionist. But at the same time, they don't have a nominee yet.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to be the party that is going to like be inspiring in 2016. And they got to be able to do that. And it is more inspiring if they can say, we compromised on this one, or we won this, and things will get even better afterwards. That is kind of the same situation Democrats were in 2008 and mm-hmm. leading up to that. So, I mean, I think that's
interesting
what we're looking at. We got to move to legislatures really quickly. You had a really interesting, and I really liked this piece in Slate on why we should be paying more attention to legislatures. And I just want to say at the outset, like, I kind of don't like our system of voting because, like, frankly, well,
federalism.
Like, how can a normal person in any day and time have researched candidates on for the state legislature, judges, which are really important, congressional level, Senate?
I think not all people can
that.
Figure
that out. That sounds
like
homework.
That not
sounds...
people can figure that out.
I'm not saying they can't figure
being
that
part
out.
Being part of participatory
saying...
democracy is homework.
You know what I want to do? I just want to...
What do you want? You people to vote by Facebook likes?
Yes. I want an app or something that I can use. Like, 10-minute quiz. I want it to, you know... You know,
I
want to
Snapchat my vote to people, and I only
want
to vote for one thing.
I don't want, no, please don't. No one should, let's not mix Snapchats and voting, because that will
no,
go bad.
No, of course, democracy puts a lot of responsibility on its participants. And there's this, people who vote carry the responsibility. But,
you are far more cheerful about this than I am.
I totally am. I think the fact that different states have different policies is an essential part of the American experiment. And it means that Colorado and Washington can try out pot. And Florida can try out school vouchers. And New York can ban fracking. And Pennsylvania can let them frack. And, you know, and we can see how these different things go and what different policy things look like. I think it's really valuable. Invaluable. Like Texas's criminal justice reform has been an example nationwide that would not have happened in DC, and that's like the 10-second defense of federalism. And also, some states are going to be better than others. So if you live in a state that sucks, you can move to another
state.
We're
moving away from federalism to, I think, just voting should be simplified, or it should be easy. There should be an easier way to learn about these candidates.
Well, I guess that's our job. Wah, wah.
Whoops. Is that what I'm supposed to be doing? Okay, so, but if you could talk about your piece for a few minutes and why people should be paying far more attention to legislatures
so,
this time.
Totally. So the lightning round on my piece is I wrote about state houses that are in play, which ones are competitive, which ones are not competitive,
and
what
Republicans
that means
cleaned up there, right?
They cleaned up in some ways, but not 100%. So what's interesting is, and actually, I was on a plane all day today, so I'm not 1,000,000% up to speed on which legislatures they won and which they didn't. But I think the two that are interesting is the Iowa Senate. Republicans have the governorship in Iowa, and they also have the Iowa Assembly, but they didn't have the Senate. And because it didn't have the state Senate, a number of sort of Texas-style abortion laws didn't get passed last time. And I spoke with Iowa Right to Life a couple days before the election, and she said, if Iowa Republicans get the Senate, which they thought was very doable given that Ernst was at the top of the ticket, if they got the Senate, they were going to push for 20-week abortion ban, a ban on doctors prescribing abortion medication via Skype instead of in person, and Democrats held the Senate. So that has an immediate impact on public policy in Iowa regarding abortion. That affects people's lives. And the other example is Arkansas, where Republicans won both houses of the legislature. And the cycle, they won the governorship and lieutenant governorship, as well as all four House seats to boot. So what that means for Arkansas is probably going to get some heavy-duty tax reform along the lines of what Kansas has. The Arkansas governor is already, or governor-elect has already been floating ideas, been discussing ideas with different think tank types. Can definitely expect rate-reducing tax reform. And that means that Iowa is probably going to look more like Kansas, for better or for worse. So that impacts people's lives. That impacts their take-home pay. That impacts potentially the kind of services that they get from their state government. And very, very important stuff. Especially, it's easier for states not to have divided government. You know, it's easier for one party to take over an entire state government.
Illinois now has a Republican-controlled state government.
Republicans control...
No, they don't control... They control one house, I think. You're gonna have to check me on that. I'm a bad Illinoisan. Because there were stories today about how Governor-elect Rauner has to deal with Mike Madigan, who is a prototypical Chicago politician. He's very powerful. He's been there forever. He's an institution. He plays hard. So the only contribution I have to this on this point is that I think people should pay more attention to state legislatures because the politicians are so awesome to cover and write about, because there's not as much focus as there is on the federal level and especially in the Senate on what they say. There aren't trackers following them. So these guys say all kinds of stuff and all kinds of stuff, crazy stuff happens, including what's happened in Virginia, where there was this sort of plan for Medicare expansion or Medicaid expansion, which related to Mark Warner got caught up in this. It's sort of crazy. So that's the only thing on that.
I'm trying to figure out if Republicans won the West Virginia House. Do you know if they won it?
I do not know. All I know is that
They did win it. I'm seeing this just now. So that's a really big deal. Mm-hmm. Republicans were expecting to flip the House. That's a very big deal for them. Democrats still control the governorship and the state Senate. But those are both going to be in play in 2016. West Virginia is a red state now. There's a very good chance Republicans will pick up both in 2016. And if that happens, we're probably going to see laws cracking down on unions, maybe in the same mold of what we've seen in Michigan and Wisconsin, which is nuts to think about because West Virginia has historically been such a union stronghold. But that's what Republicans would want to do. That's the Republican public policy position.
Continued backbreaking of unions.
Right. Which is important for Republicans because it fits with conservative ideology, especially going after public sector unions and pension reform. So there's the argument of we're doing this because we believe it's the best thing for the state. They can make that argument. But it's also very convenient because as unions get weaker and as they have fewer members, they're less effective organizing forces. They're worse at getting out the vote. And that makes it easier for Republicans to sort of shore up power that they have in these states and to keep winning. Yeah. Right. So it's a very convenient thing for Republicans to go after. Right. It has policy and political benefits. So I think we could expect to see that. But yeah.
So this is why these legislatures are important.
Very important. Dramatic impact on people's lives.
I want to, speaking about people's lives, there was a dramatic event in my life previously that I talked about with Kevin Roos, who we were very happy to be on. I was dressed in a gigantic fuzzy costume last weekend. I was Max from Where the Wild Things Are, which is actually a really good costume for Halloween because it's kind of cold and I was insulated.
Nice.
Also, what were you, Betsy?
So I didn't go with anything for Halloween because I went to Wisconsin.
Oh, right.
I was stuck in Detroit in this really crappy Days
Inn.
Wait,
you weren't stuck in Detroit?
Yes, I flew from Reagan to Detroit. And the flight was delayed by an hour, so I missed my connection. So I was stuck in Detroit for Halloween night, which is not fun. However, I had an awesome Halloween costume last year.
What was that?
Do you know Brochurance?
Yes.
It was so good. So for viewers, Brosurance was ads for the Colorado Insurance Exchange, where it showed frat bros doing keg stands, and there's like
Such
two frat
a
bros
nerdy
holding up a
costume,
third
though.
frat bro doing a keg stand. And the thing was, keg stands are crazy. Not having health insurance is crazier. Sign up for Colorado Health Exchange. So my one friend dressed up like a keg. I got like American flag shorts, and I had a baseball cap, and I had like socks rolled up. And my other friend was also a bro, and my friend with the keg like taped on a Brosurance ad. It was a really good costume. It was very easy to assemble. The only problem was like people kept being like, "What's your costume?" And I'd be like, "Do you know what Brosurance is?" And they're like, "What's that?" I'm like, "Well, I'm glad you asked. The Colorado Health Insurance Exchange."
Fucking Betsy, all the time.
Not small,
can't
like
take it. You anywhere. Okay, so is there a cut? Tell me about, because I'm new to this thing, because usually on Halloween it's I don't usually dress up. It's usually kind of a bad time for like destiny. Fate does not like me to be happy on Halloween for some reason.
Interesting. Halloween's my birthday.
Happy birthday. I'm sorry. I hope I wished you happy birthday on Facebook.
Not to worry.
So is there any rules to this Halloween thing? Does one get too old? Is one not a dignified member of the DC towniness by not wearing, you know?
I mean, I think you can keep doing Halloween through all of your 20s. I think once you hit your 30s, you're too old.
Really?
Maybe. But I think
I've got
20s, it's fine.
There are more years on that front, you know, so...
I've never loved Halloween. It's always been kind of stressful. Like, my costume last year was obviously awesome. But besides that, I'm not good at thinking of costumes. I'm always annoyed people are celebrating Halloween instead of my birthday. It's hard to have birthday parties. I can't have a birthday party on Halloween because people won't know it's my birthday. I think it's Halloween. So Halloween is always kind of irksome to me. It's not my favorite holiday, but...
Well, next year will be an off year. So, you know, it'll
yeah,
be a little bit
right.
easier. So, elections...
Yeah.
Halloween.
Next
You'll
year
just
in
have...
the midterms won't steal my birthday.
Right. You know.
That's good.
And we'll just, you know, all that.
Lots of things to look forward to.
All right, Betsy. This has
been
great as always. This is Slate's Betsy Woodruff and Daniel Strauss signing off. This is officially the last podcast we will do of the 2014. I mean, we're gonna keep talking and doing this, but this is the last. This marks our post 2014 coverage. So far,
yeah.
We're going to keep talking about campaigns and all that stuff, but we are, you know, we made it through the other end, everyone. Yes.
This is the last post-game show.
Yes, this is the last post-game show. We got, I mean, there's a lot coming up, so get ready to hear
that. That's the newer seatbelts, folks.
Yeah.
Democracy is in action.
Oh, Jesus. All right. Signing off. Bye, guys.
See ya.